from New York, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Got my mojo working, but just
one. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to take on the latest on health and healing. Good information about vitamin K2 and women's healthy artery function from the University in the Netherlands. From Curtin University, how curcumin is proven effective at combating cancer. That could save some lives. Also, how from New York University Medical Center, pollution levels linked to stroke-related narrowing of the arteries. That could save some lives. And a new study links aging with increased trust and well-being, University of Buffalo. We also will talk about exercise can help keep seniors moving longer despite old age brain decline from Rush University Medical Center, and a lot more on health and healing. And as you can see, always from the finest centers in peer-reviewed literature. And why do I say this comes from this university and published in this journal? Because historically, the mainstream, the official bearers of all supposed truths, let us believe that it is only their information coming from their doctors and their scientists that we should trust, and everything else is just anecdotal. We, on the other hand, show you it's not anecdotal. There's good quality science that they never report on. We do. Also today, I will be doing a commentary to address a lot of concern from people who read the Nation magazine article, What the Anti-Vax Movement Doesn't Tell You About Measles. And this is an important article. It was by Annie Sparrow. And I believe that Dr. Sparrow is not just wrong, but must hold responsibility for misguiding people. I will present scientific evidence from peer-reviewed literature, not opinion, not speculation. My hope is that a responsible and reasonable approach from the people at the Nation magazine who make editorial decisions would be to have someone who is a physician, a scientist, an academic, who is impartial, but will review the literature and give a proper and objective article, which this is not. I'll present my arguments today to deconstruct the fallacy of her position. Also today, time permitting, the USDA whistleblowers tell all. You may never want to eat bacon again if you do. This is a very important report from Tom Philpott from Mother Jones. Is the U.S. a fascist society? Fascism is a political economic structure which serves corporate interests. Danny Hepong from Global Research. Let's begin. We know that curcumin, which is the active ingredient in turmeric, which is the primary ingredient in curry, is good for you. So the reasoning would be that those people who eat a lot of curry are going to be healthier. And indeed, that is one possibility, especially in those countries where curry is a standard. It's in so many dishes. But then it's not the curry per se. It is the turmeric that is the active ingredient. But then there's no way of measuring the amount of turmeric in a given dish. So then, is it really the turmeric, or is it its active component, which is curcumin? And there it is. So if I were sick, or if I were wanting to prevent disease, I would focus upon the most important and concentrated healing nutrient in the curry, which is the turmeric, in the turmeric, which is their curcumin. So I'd just go straight to the curcumin. Because let's put it this way, if I were to take 2,000 milligrams a day of curcumin, which I believe would be extraordinarily beneficial for people and prevent a lot of cancer and help people with cancer, I would have to eat 2 bushel baskets full of food containing turmeric to get close to that amount. That's why a glass of juice is far more powerful than eating the vegetables. If you were to drink a glass of juice principally made up of, let's say, broccoli, not that anyone would or could, but you would have to eat a bushel basket of broccoli to to get the equivalent amount in juice. If 97% of that juice is water and you eliminate the water, what you're left with is about 3% of the total weight, but representing about 90% of what actually is healing and powerful in the broccoli. So you can eat the broccoli. That's good, and we should. You can eat the broccoli sprouts. That's far more powerful. And you can juice the broccoli. Reasonable, but it takes an awful lot of broccoli to be juiced to get any juice. Or you can take the powder, which is the most concentrated. So my analogy of using curcumin directly will help people not be confused, because frequently when people go in, they say, I heard Gary Nall mention something about a turmeric helping, and they'll give you a turmeric powder. But that's not curcumin. Curcumin is the concentrate of the turmeric. This is from Curtin University. They found that a compound, which is the curcumin, is promising, quote, treatment for most cancers and other inflammatory-driven diseases, quote, the International Review considered past clinical trials using curcumin to treat cancer patients and concluded curcumin was a safe and effective molecule to treat cancer. Curcumin University research fellow Sethi, professor, says most diseases, including cancer, are caused by the deregulation of multiple genes. To treat cancer, you need multiple targeted agents better than mono-targeted agents, which have been used for the past few years. Multiple targeted agents are those that target more than one deregulated oncogenic signaling cascade. They are more effective in treating cancer, as it has been found that several genes are mutated in a given cancer. We have modulated several such oncogenic genes which are deregulated in cancer using curcumin. So the takeaway message, curcumin is safe at high dosage. They were using as high as 12 grams with no toxicity at all. Quote, it can target most of the oncogenic proteins like NFKB, STAT3, APT1. So what that means in lay language is, if you had cancer, you'd want to use a multifactorial approach, meaning everything you could possibly do. But if there was one single item within all that protocol that's likely to make the most difference on cancer, it'd be curcumin. I would use it for every kind of cancer there is, and I would use it at high doses under medical supervision. So that's important. Also, what is important is finally appreciating that when you look outside and you see pollution, that is a false indicator of how much the air is actually polluted when you look out and don't see it. Now, we've all seen shots of factories spewing forth a toxic brew of pollutants and particulate matter, especially, let's say, in China, one of the most polluted areas in the world. But you can look outside in New York City, and it looks clear and clean. It is not. There are particulate matters everywhere. Any type of car, vehicle, truck, plane that you have, you're spewing toxins. Also, any form of manufacturing that is in a wind funnel towards you, generally west-east, you're getting pollution. Hence, China creates at least one-third of the pollution for California. But it has to go clear across the Pacific Ocean. It does. So keep in mind, once you get particulate matter in the air, it can stay up there for a long period of time and travel thousands of miles. This is the New York University Medical Center. Quote, air pollution has been linked to dangerous narrowing of neck arteries that occur prior to strokes. This is from New York City's Langone Medical Center. The scientists analyzed medical test records of more than 300,000 people living in New York and New Jersey and Connecticut. They found that people living in zip codes with the highest average levels of fine particulate matter pollution were significantly more likely to show signs of narrowing, that's a stenosis, in the carotid arteries. And so there it is. This was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology and presented at their American College of Cardiology's annual scientific session. So what's the takeaway message here? Fine particulate matter pollutants, also called PM2.5 pollutants, are particulates with diameters of less than 2.5 millionths of a meter, meaning you can't see them. And they come from the burning of engine fuels and burning wood. And they get in your body, and they can impact your stroke risk, high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, diabetics. They can impact all that. Quote from Dr. Jeffrey Berger, MD, the professor at the University Medical Center, Department of Medicine. We spend a lot of time thinking about traditional risk factors for stroke, such as high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, diabetes, and smoking, but our data underscore the possibility that everyday air pollution may also pose a significant stroke risk. So what can we do about this? Where's the good message in all this? One more reason to put an air filter in your apartment and office. Also to put plants that are known to bring in toxins from the air and release carbon dioxide and cleaner air. So it takes in pollutants, gives out healthier air. So the more plants that you put into an apartment or office, the cleaner the air. And there are special plants that are known to have greater capacities, like the spider plant, for example, and a Brazilian ivy. Also, wherever possible, just check the air. It's a simple, inexpensive device. Check the air quality in your work and your home, because in addition, you probably have some outgassing that you weren't aware of from particle board. Where do you find the particle board in an apartment? Generally in your cabinets. The kitchen cabinets almost always are made of particle board, unless you get a high-end kitchen, a pog and pole or rack pot. One of the best, they make it with hardwood. But if you use the cheaper stuff, it's always pieces of wood glued together. The glues can outgas for years. Formaldehyde in the carpet. Now, why would they put formaldehyde embalming fluid in a carpet? Same reason they put it in clothing. If you're using natural fibers, they don't have to have it with artificial fibers. But with natural fibers, you can get moss and other creatures that eat the carpet and eat the clothing. So it kills them, but it also is outgassing. So depollute your apartment. And for all the cab drivers, and we have a lot of cab drivers right now listening, and I thank you for listening, because I also know that many of you keep the radio on when you're driving. I've been told that. I've actually had friends tell me, I was in a cab and there you were on the radio, and the cab driver says, no, you got to listen to this. And we have a huge number of cab drivers as a percentage listening from the Caribbean and Haiti. You got to do several things to keep yourself healthy with those long hours. Remember, the longer you sit, the greater likelihood of thrombosis or a clot forming in the lower extremity, because visualize your leg when you're standing and walking. It's straight, just a slight bend at the knee. And every time you move, there's a contraction. Calcium is necessary for that contraction. There's a release. Magnesium is necessary for that release and keeping the muscle from being tight. But you're forcing blood. Blood going through the arteries, coming back through the veins, little valves allowing the blood to be pushed up. But when you're sitting in a cab, it's bent. Your leg is going forward, then straight down, like in an airplane or in a car or in a couch or chair. That means your blood is not circulating in the same way. You're having a pooling of blood in the venous area around the ankles and feet. That's why people sitting for a while will stand up and they'll find that they don't feel that they had their feet under them, their legs under them. Their feet or ankles might be swollen. Hence the importance of doing some exercises, walking. So my suggestion is that every 15 minutes while driving, tighten and release your calves, your thighs, and where you can, if you come to a stoplight, which you're going to, when you put your foot on the brake, just push on the ball of the foot and back and forth a little harder than you normally would. Just that simple little exercise will stimulate the contraction of the muscle forcing blood up. Also, try to use a magnetic seat cushion. That will help you because the kidneys take a real beating from being in a cab, because even though you might have some good shock absorbers, it's like putting your kidneys in a blender. They really take a hard beating. Drink a lot of water, clean water. My suggestion is for every cab driver, start your day when you're driving by taking a quart of water, cut half of it with coconut water, and then put 3 tablespoons of pure lemon juice in it. Now, if you don't have a lemon to squeeze, you can buy the organic lemon concentrate and put that in there, and then shake that up, and then throughout the day, have some of that. That's extremely important for your blood. And to keep your blood thin, make sure that you have about every 3 hours maximum, have vitamin C. It thins the blood, helping prevent strokes, helps prevent that the aggregation of the red blood cells coming together. So stop, and even if you take a moment, just pull over to the side and just get out of the car and do about 50 quarter knee bends, meaning you put your hands on your hips and you go down about 7 inches and back up. But when you come back up, come up on the toe ball of the foot. You can balance yourself on the side of your car. Put your hands on the car and now dip down about 8 inches, 9 inches, and come back up, up and down. If you did that about 50 times every 3 hours, you would make the circulation better, less chance of having a stroke or heart attack and thrombosis, and it would help circulation. Just some suggestions to help you out, okay? A good study from the University in the Netherlands found that long-term supplementation with vitamin K2 inhibited, quote, age-related stiffening of the artery walls in postmenopausal women. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Thrombosis and Hemostasis. Quote, this is the first study showing that long-term use of vitamin K2 in the form of MK7 beneficially affects cardiovascular health. And that was the professor heading the study. So women, you don't need a lot of K2, you know, 2 milligrams, 3 milligrams, that's all you need. But you could also get it if you're eating broccoli and greens, microgreens, sprouts, spinach, you'll get it there as well. It's important for you. Also, a new study links aging with increased trust and well-being. I thought this was interesting. This is the University of Buffalo. Quote, Hollywood has given moviegoers many classic portrayals of grumpy old men. American Movie Classics even maintains a list of the top 15 film curmudgeons. But new research suggests that getting older doesn't imply becoming cynical and misanthropic. Instead, aging tends to lead people to become more trusting. And that's important. That's according to this University of Buffalo study. Though trust can have negative consequences, especially among older adults at risk of exploitation from scams and fraud, University of Buffalo research shows that it can also be a resource for well-being. Studies find no evidence that those negative consequences erode the benefits of trust for older adults' well-being. Quote, both studies found a positive association between trust and well-being, which was consistent across the lifespan. The kindly old man or old woman next door is really not especially likely to yell at the kids, get off the lawn. These are more calm. These are more measured. These are more reasonable people. So the takeaway message, as we all grow older, and we all are, at different levels and different rates and different speeds, we should become more patient, thoughtful, and kind. It'll help us live a longer life. And finally, from Rush University Medical Center, published in the Neurology Peer-Reviewed Journal, exercise can help keep seniors moving longer despite old age and brain decline. So, quote, older people who are physically active may be protecting themselves from the effects of small areas of brain damage that can affect their movement abilities. So What do we learn? We learn that if we keep power walking every day, because everyone can do that, at least if they're ambulatory. If you power walk for 45 minutes a day, you're helping keep other parts of your brain from aging at the same rate. You'll be able to maintain cognition and memory and quality of life longer if you exercise every day. That's the takeaway message there. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to take a very brief break for about 10 seconds and come back, and I will be offering a commentary to offer a constructive challenge, not a personal attack. I do not believe in them, but a constructive challenge to the editors and the editorial board of The Nation magazine, which has a long and distinguished history of representing the populist perspective and has been right on so many issues. But on this one, I take exception. On this one, they are simply wrong. I hope that unlike the opinions that they can share, where they don't have to backtrack, they don't have to apologize, because ideological differences, both sides can say they're right, but not when it comes to hard science. Hard science, where we have the actual facts. When you're wrong, have the strength of character to acknowledge it and offer a point of view from those who have been attacked. I'll do that in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is our commentary section. Each week I try to write and present anywhere from 2 to 4 commentaries, either directly affecting major issues that are not being addressed appropriately or enough or fairly within the mainstream media, including even media in the alternative spheres like Mother Jones or MSNBC or PBS or NPR or The Nation magazine, that for whatever reason they have taken a decidedly very conservative right-wing alignment. When you think about it, virtually the entire pharmaceutical industry is guilty of crimes against humanity, as well as countless numbers of breaches of the public trust. We had 2 lawyers spend a year looking at all the trials and all of the settlements of the vaccine and pharmaceutical industry. All of them were guilty and had paid fines, some into the multiple billions of dollars. It was acknowledged that they knew in advance, or while they were marketing, that the product they were manufacturing or marketing was dangerous. They hid this from the public and simply added into the cost of doing business. One example was Vioxx. It killed a minimum of 60,000 people and caused hundreds of thousands of strokes and heart attacks. None of those people were followed up to see how many more of those died. They settled, but no one was found guilty. The reputation of the company was not affected. The value of its stock went up. And there we have it. That was just in 4 years. So now these same manufacturers are manufacturing vaccines. But the difference is you can't sue them. They have been indemnified. This was a political move. They paid lobbyists. The lobbyists did their job and got legislation to protect them. Now the oncologists and cardiologists and gastroenterologists and neurologists don't have that protection. If you find that they have manufactured a drug that is dangerous or caused injury, you can sue and you can collect rightful damages. Not so with vaccines. Also, it's been stated that only maximum of 10% and far likely less ever report adverse reactions. So when you hear of how many tens of thousands of people have filed actions, then you could multiply that many more times over to get a more accurate report. So now we come to this, and it usually unfortunately, in this case, it's a highly respected liberal publication, The Nation. But they had a feature article. I would like to address how I believe Dr. Annie Sparrow is wrong about her article on the measles vaccine. Her article was entitled, What the Anti-Vax Movement Doesn't Tell You About Measles. According to the recent Nation article by Dr. Annie Sparrow, measles is the world's most contagious disease. She is wrong. According to the joint CDC and World Health Organization report charting 30 contagious diseases globally, measles is third behind rotavirus and malaria. It is ranked 23rd deadliest among the top 30. Without even getting into the measles vaccine adverse effects, the vaccine has turned into a dud. This is not the opinion of vaccine opponents, but from one of the nation's staunchest pro-vaccine advocates, Dr. Gregory Poland, founding director of one of the world's premier vaccine research organizations, the Mayo Clinic's Vaccine Research Group. He is also the editor-in-chief of the peer-reviewed journal Vaccine. So you don't get any more pro-vaccine and establishment than Dr. Gregory Poland. Gregory Poland is also a CDC vaccine advisor. And during the measles outbreak in Canada, 50% of infected persons were fully vaccinated. Canada does not mandate vaccination, and only two provinces, Ontario and the sparsely populated province of New Brunswick, require four vaccines, including the MMR vaccine for school attendance. In all other provinces, vaccination is voluntary. He also estimates that the failure rate to generate sufficient antibodies could be as high as 10%. In this case, the current measles vaccine could never reach any imaginary herd immunity threshold to put an end to the disease. Articles published in the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, the CDC's MMRW reports, which provides monthly statistics of contagious disease outbreaks, measles school outbreaks affected mostly vaccinated children. So let me be clear. The majority of the measles occurred in fully vaccinated children. Among the percentage of measles cases within the vaccinated population occurring in the past few years are 1985, Corpus Christi, Texas, outbreak of measles, 99% of those infected have been fully vaccinated. In 1986, Dane County, Wisconsin, outbreak, 96% were vaccinated. In 1988, 69% of children who contracted measles that year were fully vaccinated. In 1989, 89% of children contracted measles that year were vaccinated. In 1990, 56% of all measles cases were previously vaccinated. And I could go on. I'm just giving you an example of 5 years where the majority, the vast majority of kids who got measles have been fully vaccinated. Nevertheless, a far more worrying matter is that persons vaccinated for measles become contagious carriers for several days or longer. The well-known documented cases of Measles Mary, a full vaccinated woman in the New York Theater District who infected four other persons with measles, two of which were also vaccinated, should suffice to review the expectations. This was acknowledged by the CDC's own senior epidemiologist, Dr. William Atkinson, who stated, quote, measles transmission has clearly been documented in vaccinated persons, end quote. And a 1995 Journal of Clinical Microbiology article documented that vaccinated persons could become active measles carriers. Sparrow places emphasis upon the vaccination of children. However, amidst the U.S. present vaccine hysteria, adults account for over a quarter of all measles cases. And among those contracting the virus at Disneyland, 62% were adults. Unless a vaccination is 100% effective, the wish of herd immunity can never be reached, and no vaccine is 100% effective. Moreover, pregnant women and persons with compromised immune systems, including cancer patients, are advised to avoid the measles vaccine. According to the National Institutes of Health, there are approximately 23.5 million Americans suffering from seriously compromised immune systems, or 7.3% of the U.S. population. That means they should never be vaccinated for vaccines that are contraindicated to their immune system compromised. But when was the last time a pharmacist, a physician, a nurse said, I need to know everything about your previous and current immune status? They don't. They haven't. As a result, imagine the adverse effects. In 2011, there were an estimated 13,400,000 Americans living with cancer. About 15,000 children were diagnosed with cancer every year. Measles vaccination is ill-advised for all of these people. In addition, approximately 2% of the children have egg allergies, and 1 in 2,000 Americans have mitochondrial complications. These are among some of the medical indications that necessitate children have medical examinations and to avoid vaccination at all, as it could lead to lifelong neurological impairment. And this is throughout the scientific literature. Dr. Sparrow states, quote, vaccination rates of 94% are needed to prevent measles transmission, end quote. Given her the benefit of a doubt that this figure has some relevance to reality rather than just a number based upon algorithmic calculations, it is therefore clear that a 94% rate could never be safely achieved without seriously jeopardizing the health and safety of a large part of the population who should not be vaccinated nor in contact with recent vaccines, including those millions upon millions suffering from cancer. Another caveat in the recent Disneyland outbreak concerns the particular strain of the virus. In all cases so far analyzed, it was the B3 strain that is behind the outbreak. Patient zero, who would have been initially responsible for the outbreak, has never been identified, and therefore it is unknown whether he or she was vaccinated or not. The current measles vaccine utilizes the A strain virus, which seemingly is the most prevalent. Pro-vaccine advocates claim the current measles vaccine protects against all 9 strains. However, research proves this claim is inconclusive. We know that influenza vaccines require an exact match in order to provide protective immunity from flu outbreaks of a given strain. For this reason, a poor match, such as in this year's influenza vaccine, it will not protect vaccinated persons. The 2014 flu shot was only 19% effective. I repeat, 19%. Or another way, it was 81% ineffective. Yet all people thought that they would be protected, and the medical community and all the physicians and the CDC did not tell people of the statistical differences. Measles is a more difficult to determine disease because the virus does not mutate as rapidly and frequently as the influenza virus. There are no reliable scientific studies showing the effectiveness of the current A strain measles vaccine against non-A strain, although it does appear to provide some degree of immunity, at least for some persons. If the current vaccine only gives minimal protection against other measles strains, this might explain why so many vaccinated persons contract measles. Making matters far worse, and which reveals the ludicrous logic in mass measles vaccinations, is that cancer and individuals with a compromised immune system are advised to avoid being in the presence of any person recently vaccinated with the live virus vaccines, including measles, influenza, and chickenpox. A recent measles vaccinated person can carry the virus and potentially transmit it for up to 2 weeks. Even the Kimmel Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins, in its material for care at home recommendations for immunocompromised patients, advises against these patients being exposed to recently vaccinated individuals. So what is the actual situation that we have before us? How many people who were vaccinated against measles first had their immune system evaluated, and then how many of those people vaccinated went home and were exposing for up to 2 weeks people with compromised immune systems? Well, do the math. It is simple. If you have 14 million people suffering from cancer, 15 million, and you figure there's 4 people per average per household, then how is it not possible when you have such a high degree of immunization against the measles for people who should not be exposed to the measles being exposed? Who takes responsibility for this glaring oversight? First, we have a significant percentage of the U.S. population, between 10 and 12%, who either should not receive the measles vaccine or is jeopardizing everyone else they come into contact with recently vaccinated individuals. The vaccine itself fails up to 10% of the time, and immunity appears to be rapidly waning within 7.5 years, according to Mayo Clinic's Dr. Polin. Together, it can be estimated that the vaccine is ineffective or dangerous for over 20% of the American population. Ergo, the magic number for reaching herd immunity is not possible. It is mathematically impossible. It is also unrealistic. So where is the reasoning behind articles, behind diatribes, behind personal attacks, behind ad hominem attacks happening about 60 times a day? Through a concerted effort throughout the mass media, not one of those mass media or its health reporters or the health reporters for the New York Times or anyone else challenging the information they're being given. It is my personal opinion that when all you're doing is asking the public to trust you because of your credentials, that we misdirect the entire argument. I do not have any respect for propagandists for any cause. I want to look at the facts for myself and come to some reasoned conclusion based upon what the actual evidence is. On the other hand, the government wants to vaccinate everyone for measles so they can in turn become carriers and transmit the virus to not only the unvaccinated, but worse, to those who are already immunocompromised and where a measles infection can be deadly. Hence, rather than measles being a localized problem, mass vaccination programs will make it a national problem. Is there something direly wrong with this picture? Dr. Sparrow believes that the measles vaccine, quote, is not only safe, but mass measles vaccination is also the single best public health intervention we have, end quote, from The Nation magazine. Before the vaccine was introduced, measles rarely ever occurred in infants, while breastfeeding was still the norm. It is believed that mothers passed on their natural immunity to their babies. However, by 1993, 25% of measles cases were occurring in infants. In the Vaccine Safety Manual, published in 2008, the CDC suggests that the increase in infant measles cases was due to the rise in vaccinated mothers. That's the CDC saying this. Finally, how much faith should we put into the published scientific literature on the measles vaccine? If the vaccine is to be mandated by government decree, then it should follow that such a decision is founded upon clear and unambiguous science. According to a thorough 2012 155-page review of all published scientific literature on the MMR vaccine, the Cochrane Collaboration, the world's preeminent, most respected international organization assessing the validity of drugs, medical devices, and vaccine studies, stated, quote, despite its worldwide use, no systematic review studying the effectiveness and safety of the MMR vaccines are available. Let me repeat this for the absolutely certain Dr. Sparrow's views that, quote, the measles vaccine is not only safe, but measles vaccine is also the single best public health intervention we have. Quote, now this is from the group that is working with pure science, and they're the most respected in the world. Quote, despite its worldwide use, no systematic reviews studying the effectiveness and safety of the MMR vaccines are available, end quote. Among the review's conclusions, quote, the design and reporting of safety outcomes in MMR vaccine studies, both pre- and post-marketing, are largely inadequate. It's that simple. The real science says it best. The MMR vaccine safety in both pre- and post-marketing are largely inadequate. With such uncertainty in the effectiveness, safety, and vaccine viral transmission of measles, and how the vaccine compromises the health of millions of Americans, in my personal opinion, it is grossly negligent to enforce measles vaccination. And at the state level, I believe it is criminal. I believe that rather than the vaccine being a public health intervention, as the science now stands, the measles vaccine is a huge public health risk. Until such time that quality, independent, non-industry affected studies are done, when independent scientists who have no connection to the vaccine industry or the governmental agencies have done a thorough review, then all they're doing is experimenting with the public. Additionally, I would like to cite something that the American media has chosen not to review or doesn't know about it, and certainly any physician or scientist should know about this. Because it was published in the peer-reviewed literature by a medical doctor and also has a master's in science, Dr. Mark Girard. It was published in the Journal of the American Physicians and Surgeons, Volume 11, Number 1, and here's what it says. While much information, this is the abstract, while much information concerning World Health Organization recommendations on vaccines, particularly against hepatitis B, remains secret, there is sufficient evidence in the open literature to suggest scientific incompetence, misconduct, or even criminal malfeasance. The benefits are overstated and toxicity greatly understated. Influenza vaccine recommendations falsely imply that the available vaccines could help prevent avian influenza. After the universal campaign of vaccination against hepatitis B was launched in France in September 1994, upon the recommendations of the World Health Organization, a criminal inquiry was opened because of the demand by the relatives of people, some of them children, who had died after being immunized. Having been commissioned as a medical expert witness by the French judge, I spent thousands of hours on this subject and have access to dozens of confidential documents. Although my reports are still secret by court order, a number of my findings were leaked after being transmitted to the litigants. Thus, it is possible to find a significant echo of my observations and published data. The main points of this paper were taken from an open letter sent to the World Health Organization Director General, which remains unanswered. Hepatitis B epidemiology. In February 2004, I read correspondence from an Italian colleague on the fallacies of the data disseminated by the World Health Organization about the epidemiology of hepatitis B in this country. Although not well informed about the health situation in India, I was struck by the fact that the mechanisms of the deception as described in this letter, lack of references, inappropriate extrapolations, and gross exaggerations were exactly comparable to those I observed in my own country. The results were also the same, a plea by so-called experts to include hepatitis B vaccination in the nation's vaccine program. In spite of its cost and its unprecedented toxicity, there are stunning fallacies underlying this plea for universal vaccination. In a paper published no less than 10 years after the start of the information campaign launched by the World Health Organization instigation, two eminent representatives of the Director General of the French Center for Disease Control and Prevention blandly recognized that there was up to a 700% uncertainty about the French figures for the incidence of hepatitis B. One may wonder whether the average American citizen would take seriously the results of U.S. Census showing that this country had between 250 million and 1.7 billion inhabitants. How is it possible to rely upon so-called experts who, in assessing involving huge financial costs as well as hazards threatening newborns or very young children, apparently accept uncertainties that would be viewed as ludicrous in demographic counts? In the same paper, the authors admitted without the slightest irony that the French figures about chronic liver disease were simply extrapolated from the U.S. reports. Yet no great epidemiological expertise is needed to grasp that extrapolating U.S. data on chronic liver diseases to the country of France, in other words, to a country that probably has the highest rate of alcohol-induced disease, probably does not meet the requirements of scientific rigor. More recently, an American expert working for the World Health Organization claimed that 250,000 people die of hepatitis B in India based upon a model stratified for geographic region and income groups. Indian skeptics, however, suggest that this alleged model never existed and that the initial figures given should be refined towards far less alarming assessments. Such practices that are similarly exaggerations about the French situation would normally be considered fraudulent, yet they triggered no reaction from the World Health Organization when they were made public. despite the blatancy of falsifications and in the face of serious adverse health consequences of the French campaign. The Indian government has, more than 10 years later, decided to include hepatitis B vaccine in its national program. This decision is explicitly based upon the World Health Organization's assessment. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization and its so-called experts go on publishing reassuring statements based upon an explicit reference to a safety study that, according to public communiques between the French agency, decided to, quote, disregard an unfortunate misprint of a table. Uncorrected, to my knowledge, allows the authors to have the clear increase of multiple sclerosis in vaccinated teenagers and young adults. Such an error would be normally leading one to suspect fraud. In the promotion of the hepatitis B vaccination, the World Health Organization has evidently served merely as a screen for commercial promotion, in particular via the Viral Hepatitis Prevention Board, which was created and sponsored and infiltrated by the manufacturers of the vaccine. And then it goes on from there, and it literally eviscerates everything that you could imagine on the hepatitis B vaccine, because many of us have asked, why would a baby just born that has no hepatitis signature at all in the body, whose mother has shown to be hepatitis negative, why would you give them such a powerful, toxic vaccine to be so disruptive to their natural, non-defined immune system? It made no sense. There's no logic. There's no concord of reason here. Follow the money trail. As far as the avian influenza, quote, this new awareness of the World Health Organization's questionable behavior and its tragic consequences in terms of health and financial costs occurs in the context of another scandal, again involving the World Health Organization. Avian influenza. It appears that under the lame pretext of increasing the manufacturing potential, the manufacturers managed to induce the World Health Organization so-called experts to recommend an influenza vaccination, whereas it is plain that this immunization would have no protective effect against the avian influenza. In both situations, the methods was the same. First, create a false alarm about the inefficiency of targeted vaccination in the case of hepatitis B, and about the necessity of increasing the manufacturing process in the case of the avian influenza. Next, induce World Health Organization to plead for measures based upon misleading recommendations to lay people, stating that everyone was at risk of hepatitis B, or implying that influenza was such a serious disease that it required mass vaccination. Then so-called specialists currently working for the World Health Organization go into support. In conclusion, from Dr. Mark Girard, medical doctor, in this peer-reviewed article, quote, there's an urgent need for an independent inquiry about the process leading the World Health Organization to recommend measures favorable to drug makers' interests, even when they are based on scientifically irrelevant or falsified information. It is time to differentiate between the interests of the World Health and that of the World Health Organization experts. End quote. Also, from the former Merck doctor, says Gardasil vaccine is deadly, from Natural Health. Quote, as parents increasingly feel pressure to expose their children to the harms of the Gardasil vaccine, evidence continues to grow that they need to stand their ground. The very vaccine that government officials and physicians alike are pushing on families is being further exposed as a pharmaceutical product that a growing list of experts characterize as overly expensive, ineffective, and potentially deadly. Since its approval by the Food and Drug Administration, Merck and company's Gardasil vaccine has been at the center of a firestorm of controversy, ignited by a mounting body of evidence suggesting that reassurances from the physicians and pharmaceutical companies and television commercials are not to be believed when it comes to the HPV vaccine dangers. Among the long list of experts speaking out against the Gardasil shot is Dr. Bernard Dalberke, former pharmaceutical physician for the vaccine's manufacturer Merck, who has gone on record as criticizing the pharmaceutical industry and Gardasil in particular. Dr. Alberku was quoted in April of 2014 by a leading French magazine as predicting that the Gardasil vaccine, which he describes as, quote, useless and highly expensive, will go down in history as one of the greatest medical scandals of all time. He says, quote, the evidence will add up to prove that this vaccine, technical and scientific feat that it may be, has absolutely no effect on cervical cancer, and that all of the many adverse effects which destroy lives and even kill serve no other purpose than to generate profit for the manufacturer. End quote. And that is from one of the top physicians working for the vaccine manufacturer directly. And by the way, why haven't the hundreds of parents of young, healthy teenage girls who died right after taking the Gardasil vaccine, why haven't they been quoted and interviewed? Why haven't the scientists who've studied the toxicology of this been interviewed? Gardasil, sometimes referred to as the human papillomavirus vaccine, is administered in 3 shots over a course of 6 months, supposedly to protect against the human papillomavirus infection and its complications, including cervical cancers in women. The vaccine is also marketed as offering protection against genital warts as well as cancers of the anus and the vulva and the vagina. Unlike other human papillomavirus vaccines, Gardasil is given to males as well as females. In addition to pain and fever seen with a host of vaccines, the reported side effects of Gardasil also include debilitating and deadly complications as paralysis of the lower limbs, vaccine-induced multiple sclerosis, cases of vaccine-induced encephalopathic and conditions, and sudden death. The CDC has repeatedly sung the praises of Gardasil vaccine, recommending that girls and boys receive 3 doses in time to develop immune response before becoming sexually active. In the United States, the vaccine has been strongly and consistently pushed to parents, while the most serious side effects are often swept under the rug. And right now, in every one of the states, there is a massive movement by the pharmaceutical companies to get it mandated as mandatory. So, while families are not able to bring lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers, data from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reveals a horrible irony. Nearly $6 million has been awarded to victims in claims involving the very human papilloma vaccine the government is trying to force on humans. Why isn't this a part of our discussion and debate? I'm Gary Nall. Tomorrow on our program, I will share with you from one of the nation's leading constitutional scholars, Jonathan Emord. He has won more cases against the FDA than any other lawyer in American history. He will share with you the idea that we are approaching the point of proposing forced vaccination laws comparable to eugenics forced sterilization laws in the United States. Remember, we had sterilization laws in the United States. Who were sterilized? Go back into your history. I suggest The Nation magazine go back and look at some of their earlier articles on women, women of color, those who were poor. Those were the only ones ever sterilized. Tens of thousands. I don't think they realized the consequences of not looking at all the science before they brought out such a disturbing article. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. And we're coming up near the end of our program. Not enough time to open our calls, but I have a lot to share on tomorrow's show. Unfortunately, I'm doing this. I say unfortunately because there are so many other topics I'd like to cover, but how many forums do you know that reach as many people as we reach are there to every time there's a, you know, attack against homeopathy saying every single study shows it doesn't work? Well, we show that they're wrong, and I will deal with that tomorrow. Or when there's attack by The Nation magazine against those who have studied vaccines and chosen through informed consent not to vaccinate, I'm the one that has to do this because there aren't other forums to reach this people. They're reaching massive forums, the USA Today and National Geographic, and the New York Times, and Nation Magazine. All over the left is fully supportive vaccines, big pharma. And so we have to do this, or there wouldn't be any voices out there to offer counterpoint of view. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.